Welcome to Not Enough Champagne, a podcast positively seething with goodwill. My name's Corey Hazelhurst, and with me are wise old owl John Cotton.
Hello.
Upstart crow Luke John Davis.
Hello.
Red Robin Bridget Jones.
Hello.
And Christmas turkey Steve Haynes.
God damn it, Corey.
This is our review of British politics in 2019. Partly for clicks and partly out of despair, we're going to entitle it, Is Britain a Failed State? First dibs on this, so we've probably got time to go to the pub, read the newspaper.
Actually, this one's a really short answer. Ask me the question.
Okay, LJ, is Britain a failed state?
No.
Okay.
Essentially, what's happening is a confusion between the state and politics. So, in terms of a failed state, if you look at places that actually are failed states, I mean Syria, Somalia, Yemen, and so on, what you have there is a complete breakdown not only of politics but also of society and of the state administrative functions. If you look at the United Kingdom, you know, the legal system still functions. If you go outside and kick a police car or whatever you choose to do to break the law.
Is that the first?
That was just the first thing that came to
the first, okay.
You know, you will still go to prison. So the justice system is still working. It's creaking. Don't get me wrong, there is still issues, but the justice system works. Hospitals are still open and running. You know, yes, there is a lot of potential issues around drug shortages if no deal Brexit happens. But right now, you know, if one of us fell over and broke a leg, we could go to A&E and be reasonably certain of being seen quite quickly. Children still go to school. The concept of it being a failed state is, I think, severely hyperbolically overblown. The issue comes around to politics.
I would take some issue with that and go for not quite yet. So if you look at the law and order, whilst the courts may be functioning, the chances of you winding up in a court in the first place are decreasingly small. There's a huge, huge number of smaller, more minor crimes, actually more major crimes as well, that the police simply aren't attending because they don't have the capacity. I know pub landlords who have been beaten up in their own pubs. Police haven't come around for days. I know people who have been burgled. Police haven't come around for days. There is an excellent chance if you are a victim of personal crime, the police won't be able to attend because they simply do not have the time. Actually getting a prosecution, even if they are there, is incredibly hard because of the pressures on them to do the work to get things there. So I think things are a lot worse than the public, or certainly the media has really picked up on yet. You go to your hospital, it's not actually that quick a wait to get seen via broken leg. It can be several hours. We're talking about some of the longest waiting times we've ever had. Schools starting to close early on a Friday in across Birmingham because they don't have the money to stay open. We are starting to look at the potential breakup of the United Kingdom. We've got Brexit coming. The recession that's going to follow Brexit is going to be, I think, quite extraordinary.
So, the Fund for Peace says there's four characteristics of a failed state, which are loss of control of territory or losing a monopoly of legitimate force. The other one is erosion of legitimate authority to make collective decisions. Third one is an inability to provide public services. And the fourth one is the inability to interact with other countries as a full member of the international community. So, if we go through those kind of one by one, obviously, loss of control of territory. You've alluded already, Bridget, to the breakup of the UK. So one of the knock-on effects of the election result, which I think we touched on last week, is that the result of the for the SNP means that there's going to be more pressure for a Scottish independence referendum. And also the reality of Boris Johnson's Brexit deal, which we've talked about a couple of times in the podcast, Steve, is that could well lead to the reunification of Ireland, given if there's border checks and what have you. So I think there is a real danger of the union breaking up in about 10 or 15 years.
Yeah, I think that we are very much in a position where from the perspective of like the union, we could be in for a very interesting constitutional time. As you say, like the situation in Scotland is now such that within another 5, potentially 10 years of Tory rule, you're going to end up with a much kind of harder case to make for Scottish unionists, and you can easily see Scotland going for independence as a result of that. I personally think at this point it's almost kind of moot as to when it happens, but it is going to happen now. I think
there's a difference here in terms of you're talking about control from Westminster. Now, that territory would still be under control of a political unit, whether that unit is based in Holyrood, Stormont, Dublin, Westminster. The state would still be controlling that territory. You're not looking at something like ISIS, where the state is under control of a non-democratic or non-politically legitimate group.
Labour activist compares SNP to ISIS. That's the headline I
want
to see.
I'm okay with that.
But yeah, I think LJ is actually right with that. There is his mainline distinction at the beginning of the episode between like the politics of the situation and like the governance level, I suppose.
Sort of the technocratic administrative state functions.
Those are very different things. I think at the moment the UK is, it's still functioning, but it is going through some, it's potentially going to go through some major constitutional upheavals. Like we said, Scotland, the fact that we've now we're seeing like, unionists like Nigel Dodds losing their seats to Sinn Féin, that's significant. It's not like it's a shift from, one unionist party to another unionist party. It's a shift from a unionist party to a nationalist one.
I think the ISIS comparison...
I was just saying that the SNP was specifically not like ISIS. Like, it was a contrast, not a comparison,
Labour,
which I feel is a valid
nice
point.
Comparison.
LJ will be visiting Edinburgh in...
for his apology tour.
the Jail of Edinburgh. Edinburgh County.
So I think it'll be less of an ISIS, more of a Barcelona, or a Catalonia, actually.
That's really what I said.
Where what we saw in Catalonia was a frustrated group of people, roughly, who decided to hold their own independence referendum because they couldn't get any traction with it nationally. It's playing out interestingly there. The massive consequence of the people that went ahead with it, but I don't think it's inconceivable we could see some ballsy moves like that in Scotland.
Were they roughly frustrated or roughly people?
Obviously, the nature of the episode title is quite hyperbolic, but actually you look at the difference of the Cameron government dealing with Scottish independence in 2014 with the reaction of the Spanish government and the Catalonia referendum. It is two very different responses.
Bridget has actually made the reference that I wanted to in terms of Catalonia. I think what we're seeing here is this isn't a failed state for all the reasons that have been set out, but it's a state that's now showing significant signs of malfunction, and certainly in constitutional terms I think that's what we're seeing, and the potential for the UK as an entity to break down, and I think it is quite extreme.
And is that maybe the wider point, LJ, is that in terms of, yes, okay, if Scotland goes independent they will have a functioning government, it won't end up being like Syria but with North Sea oil, but in terms of the UK, if we think about kind of the ancient Greek term about the polis, and that you need a kind of set area of your territory, that actually there are certain groups within the UK who don't want to be part of that polis anymore?
Yeah, so I think that's definitely true. But I mean, that's definitely been true for quite some time. But I think it's not going to be a similar situation to Yugoslavia, for example. I don't think we'll end up seeing a violent conflict around Scotland. Now, there is a potential that we could see that in Northern Ireland. But I think for Scotland, I think that's a different case. What's going to be interesting here is this is a constitutional crisis, and it's looking at specifically how it works. So, as we all know, thanks to Brexit, Parliament is sovereign in the United Kingdom. And what that means is that Parliament cannot bind another Parliament or, in a sense, give away its own power, except in the terms of devolving someone to do it on their behalf. And that's what we saw with the 2014 Scottish referendum. Essentially, because constitutional matters are reserved for the Westminster Parliament, the Cameron government agreed formally to devolve on a one-time only basis that specific decision to Holyrood. So that's a gift, if you like, of the Westminster Prime Minister. And Boris Johnson has already said that he is not minded to do that. Now, the question then is, what do the SNP do? Because if they could hold a referendum that is not legally binding, if that produces a majority for independence, do they then... Well, they obviously then push for a legally binding one from Westminster. If Boris Johnson refuses, I suspect that ends up in the Supreme Court, which is, of course, a very new entity in the United Kingdom, and I don't think any of us know what way they would rule.
There's also something else to bear in mind in this context, which is as we focus on particularly Northern Ireland and Scotland, and the implications of that, quite rightly, the danger is that the frustrations in the English regions get overlooked. Mm-hmm. And this further feeds into what we've seen playing out for some time, that sense that certainly as he moved into the Midlands and the North, he completely divorced from the Westminster politics, that sense of frustration, that sense of we're just locked out economically, socially, constitutionally. And there's a real danger of that blowing up as there's a focus on what's happening in Scotland and in Northern Ireland. And I think, you know, certainly if there's a failure to honour some of those big promises that the newly elected Johnson government has made to those communities, that could spin out of control in some quite worrying ways as well.
So I think that leads us quite nicely onto the second reason for failsafe, or the second category. The second criteria for failsafe, which is the erosion of legitimate authority to make collective decisions. So I think there's a few different things we could touch on here that have happened over the past 12 months, 2 years or so. So one of them is, so you talked about LJ in your earlier kind of defence, I suppose, or scepticism to the fact that Britain's a failed state, the fact that you get tried in courts for committing offences and what have you. And actually, I think, for me, part of the reason the social fabric's starting to crumble a little bit is the attitude to judges and the courts that we see. So we've already seen newspaper headlines saying that judges are enemies of the people. There are a lot of people questioning the political bias of the Supreme Court justices when they heard the prorogation decision outside Parliament. The contempt for politicians and political parties feels like it's getting an all-time high, and it also feels like quite violent hatred often. The other thing as part of that is the failure, and we talked about this, Steve, a couple of weeks ago with the Ivan Rogers speech, the failure of the UK political class generally to try and find a resolution for Brexit that the majority of the British public supports. So we are in a situation where in 2 months' time, the Johnson government will pass a withdrawal agreement that does not have the consent of the majority of the British public. And that, to me, is a massive problem.
I can understand what you're coming from that, but I think there's several things around this. First of all, for all we are sitting there saying that, you know, we don't like the voting system or what have you, the simple fact is that we've accepted the result of the election. You know, beyond one or two conspiracy cranks on Twitter, no one is saying that this election was not legitimate and shouldn't be respected. You know, for all of the headlines and the disrespects that people like the Daily Mail showed towards the Supreme Court justices, nobody seriously considered refusing their decision. Parliament was recalled. Whilst I can understand what you're saying in that and the questioning around that, actually in terms of the questioning of legitimacy there, I don't think we are at the state of a failed state at all.
So I think turnout is something that we need to watch closely, and who hasn't been turning out. So 1 in 3 people in the UK didn't think that turning up to a ballot box on Thursday was going to make enough difference to their lives to make it worth doing. They didn't believe in the system enough to go, or the people on offer enough to go out and cast a vote as to who was going to lead them. Although it's a small decrease in turnout since last time, there is a fundamental question for any democracy when you have that level of people opting actively out of the system. The other one on legitimacy for me is devolution. Because we have such huge variations in regions according to who they vote for, we're one of the most centralised countries in Europe. Whilst we have devolution to the regions to varying, to the nations to varying extents, we don't have it to our regions or cities in even remotely the level that any other country in Europe does. And I think part of the solution to restoring trust in politics and people believing that it will make a difference to their lives is increasing devolution in this country, so that the decision makers are closer to an area and also more reflective of those who vote in that area.
I think on this question of sort of legitimacy and trust in the system, that there is an argument for saying, well, it was ever thus. Because, you know, politicians have always been held in pretty low esteem, somewhere between estate agents and journalists, depending on where you are. The Daily Mail and other media outlets have always said very populist, you know, unpleasant things that have been aimed at the political system, the courts, certain groups within society. And I do wonder how some of this is just a reflection of the fact that because we are now far more connected because of social media and everything else, it's just a lot more visible. These were conversations that used to happen in a corner in the pub. Now they're happening out there on Twitter or on Facebook, and people are just far more engaged and aware of some of the stuff that's out there that's quite cynical about the system. But I do think there is an increasing ugliness and almost sort of violent subtext to some of this that we haven't seen before. And that has played, you know, we're in a situation where it's within very recently we've seen a member of parliament murdered while they were going about doing their work as an MP in the constituency. And there's an ugly subtext, I think, that you see in terms of how people are talking about others, which worries me for the stability of our political system. The other point is, I think you're quite right, Bridger, about the importance of a settlement that really devolves power, because I think that sense of disconnect, the further you get away from London, is quite powerful and visible. Unless we address that, we are going to have difficulties.
Under pretty much everything we're talking about here, like, I know, you know, the people calling judges enemies of the people, all of that sort of high-level critique of cornerstones of the Constitution. If you look at, say, America, for instance, that happens a lot, regardless of whether you're left-wing, right-wing. You know, the way the media is over there is in a lot more ways very more open with its biases in both directions, which means when you had liberal rulings on the Supreme Court, the right-wing media goes into a frenzy. When you have more conservative leanings from the Lean Part, the liberal media goes into a frenzy as well. Pretty much everything we're discussing here also happens in the US. I think you'll also, if you look into it, it probably also happens in Australia. I'm only using those ones as examples, for instance, because those are English-speaking countries. If we were to look at other ones as well, I'm sure we'd probably find it in Germany, in France, in Poland, in wherever, because I think it is just something that happens. So if we're saying Britain is a failed state because of that, then every state is a failed state.
Well, I suppose the political system in America is working perfectly at the moment.
No, but it's not necessarily brilliant, but it's not... This stuff was happening under George W. Bush. This stuff was happening under Bill Clinton as well. And a lot of those sorts of things were. Like, you can make a strong case that it's gotten worse or is getting worse.
So something we didn't talk about on the election show last week, I'm going to say post-truth nature of campaigning and the role of the BBC and the media, and the BBC, let's be fair, didn't really have a great campaign. Now, admittedly, a lot of it isn't new. So one of the things I was listening to on the train to and from Wolverhampton on the way to campaigning was a book about the 1960 election. The Kennedy campaign put out an edited video of the first debate that they did with Nixon. So you know that the famous one where Nixon's kind of sweaty and what have you. So they edited it to look like Nixon was nodding along and agreeing to what Kennedy was saying, and they strung lots of Kennedy soundbites together in one coherent bit, which reminded me very much of the Keir Starmer video that he did, the interview with Good Morning Britain that the Tory party put out. Mm. And actually the reaction from a lot of the Republican reaction to that Kennedy video was, this reminds me of the dark days of campaigning in the past when people used to edit candidate speeches. So even in 1960, I suppose fake news and misleading statements in political campaigns was nothing new. But is there something new about the post-truth nature of the election campaign we had? The fact that you had the fact check Twitter account, the fact that you've got the BBC political editor essentially just tweeting out allegations she gets from anonymous Tory sources as fact.
So I think the new thing is no one cares. You can fake everything, you can pump out literally lies and no one cares, and there is no recrimination anymore because it is either expected or the people calling it out for lies are simply disbelieved. And that's really, really scary for me.
I don't believe you.
I'll just rebrand myself as fact check and take that argument down. I mean, you've just set out, there's an argument for saying that this is also as old as the hills. And there has always been dodgy practices, people cutting fast and loose with the facts.
Not in our election campaign.
Absolutely never. But you talk about Kennedy, and then there's the famous Lyndon Johnson one, isn't there, about spreading an absolute lie about an opponent and just saying, well, I just want to see him try and deny it.
Mm.
Yeah, some of this has always happened, and you can overstate the import. You can overstate the degree to which things have changed. That's what I'm trying to say there. Where I think there is an issue is when you see the methods that we now have, particularly the kind of use of Facebook data and things like that, to be able to target stuff really below the radar. There was something about if you were telling lies or mistruths through a leaflet or through the use of the mainstream print media or whatever it was, or the editing of a film that you put out, that everybody kind of sees that and shares in that experience. It's a collective thing and it can be challenged. Whereas if you are quite covertly targeting messages and sometimes very misleading messages and ideas to individuals, and you're not able to monitor that. That's where I think we've got a bigger issue, and this is something that we've got to grapple with globally, because clearly this has been happening in the States, it's been happening here, it's happening in all the kind of developed democracies. That's the bit that I think is really different and really troubling.
I mean, yeah, so I was going to have 2 points. John has very eloquently explained the first point I was going to make, which was around social media. But I think the second point is the nature of the news media has changed dramatically from those sort of 60s, 70s elections to now, in that it is now a 24-hour media phenomenon. And what that means is that there is a huge amount of pressure on journalists to be the first and to get the scoop. And that means that they are prioritising speed over accuracy. So when Laura Koonsberg, and Laura, I'm just using this as an example, Laura Koonsberg is, you know, probably actually one of the lesser villains in this piece, I think, for all of the vitriol she gets from both sides. But when she gets the tweet about Labour protester punched an aide outside Leeds Hospital, the reason she tweets that out straight away is because if she doesn't, somebody else does. And her job is basically based on the fact that she has to get there first, and otherwise she loses her livelihood. Now, you know, when the video later emerges and it turns out that what happened is that the guy's holding his hand out and no one's paying attention, and the aide accidentally walks into his outstretched hand, that then obviously makes the journalistic profession look bad. And I think this is a symptom of the fact that journalism is now predicated on speed rather than accuracy.
Kind of links back to some of the conversations we've had on previous episodes when we've been talking about the role of the BBC and how it needs to adapt and change for the 21st century, is that it's still trying to be unbiased. Mm-hmm. And being unbiased is not the same thing as being factual. Mm-hmm. So you still end up with these situations where the BBC isn't necessarily challenging blatant lies in the same kind of way as it should do. That could be perceived as being biased.
Well, a good example of that is a story that they put out, I think, in the final week of the election campaign about misleading political advertisements, which found that Labour had made no misleading statements. And the Tories, I think 88% of the content they'd looked at was misleading. And that was framed, as you say, in a kind of both sides, well, you can't trust politicians, can you? Yeah. Narrative. When actually, that's not the evidence they've found.
In that instance, a proper bit of journalism is to basically say, this report has come out, this is what the report says, and then to draw no value judgment. It is just a reporting of the facts. What the BBC did there was, because of its commitment to being unbiased in its charter, it is obligated to do this. It has to basically pull this both sidisms, which is just nonsense.
What's the definition of unbiased? And it's that famous quote that's going around social media and has been for a while. You know, when one person is telling you that it's sunny and one person's telling you it's raining, your job isn't to give them both equal airtime, it's to look out the window.
And so moving on then, the third criteria for failed states is the inability to provide public services. So, Bridget, you've talked about, touched on this already. A couple of big issues in the election campaign were about the fact that essentially the NHS does not have enough beds. There was the four-year-old child, wasn't there, on the hospital ward, which actually we could have used as an example of fake news spreading as well, but is a very good example of the NHS not having capacity.
I mean, the child on the hospital floor was probably the low point of the campaign for me. I almost found myself crying looking at the Prime Minister's reaction to that and realising he genuinely didn't care. Even my cold heart was almost moved to tears over that. I don't think we have an inability to provide public services. It is a choice. The government is choosing not to properly fund public services. And that is what is leading to what we are seeing. The ability is there. The money could be found. The choices could be made. The priorities could be made. But they systematically haven't been for many, many years. How that changes post-Brexit, as our economy changes quite drastically, remains to be seen. Will that be an ability or a choice? We'll have to wait and see what happens.
Yeah, it's at the moment, what's happening in public services is the result of a failed political choice rather than a systematic failure of the state. Clearly we have got the resources there to organise and deliver public services, and public services are still being delivered, albeit some of them very, very poorly and in an increasingly creaking fashion. You know, not just health, if you look at social care as well, which I think is the big crisis that we've well, we all know this is the big crisis coming down the tracks. And everybody goes, yes, we must do something about it, and then does exactly nothing, and on it trundles, whilst all the focus is on the sort of the really visible signs of the crisis, which are the scenes in hospitals, which are absolutely appalling. But the, what's really driving this is the failure to fix the social care crisis, which has just been left to local government to sort out largely. I think where the danger of it moving into failed state territory starts to emerge is one, as Bridget has just said, what Brexit may or may not do in terms of the impact on the wider economy and our ability to resource those public services. But also, again, the promises that were made during the course of this election by the Conservatives, who now have a majority to deliver these things, made a whole series of promises around public services to communities that have not traditionally voted Conservative and have elected them this time. If they then fail to deliver on those promises, you then get into a really serious political breakdown, I think. And the consequences of that do then tip you into potentially failed state territory, because it starts to affect some of the other factors that we've just been talking about.
Because I think a consequence of the cuts, and I don't know if you guys were aware, but Birmingham City Council's had quite a few cuts over the last few years.
Has it?
Apparently. Good to know.
Well,
yeah.
I must check that out when I get back to the office.
It doesn't make it failed state status, but 9 years on, Britain is a dirtier, grubbier place as a result of these cuts as well. So, social, as you say, NHS, schools, social care is where we're seeing on a day-to-day basis. But you're also seeing on a day-to-day basis in our parks, on our streets.
Corey's building up to basically say we need to fix the floozy, just for you listeners at home.
I was just amazed it took us this long to come onto the bin strikes.
Did that make Birmingham a failed state? Good discuss.
Not a state.
When he said dirtier, grubbier and looking more haggard, I just thought he meant me after 10 years. But
I think all of us after that election campaign looked dirtier and more haggard.
Fourth and final criterion then was the inability to interact with other countries as a full member of the international community. Now, Steve.
Well, Corey, I think this is one where there's probably is actually a strong case to be made at the moment that on this criteria we probably would class, in to some degree at least, as a failed state, simply because the policy decisions around Brexit put us in a limbo. Where we have not been able to do anything because we don't know what our core relationship is going to be looking like, and as a result of that, we haven't been able to interact with everything and anything. We've not been able to kind of really get involved with anything in the EU. We can't branch out and make any more significant alliances or trade deals or anything like that because we're all still part of the customs union until we leave it. So on this one, you could make a reasonably strong case for it. Doesn't on its own, I don't think it makes Britain a strong failed state. But this one, I feel you can put a tick next to it.
I'm going to disagree with Steve on this one because it's still an interaction. Now, you know, no, we're not participating in the EU in the same way that we were, certainly, but we are still interacting with them. You know, we are not being, you know, there are no EU sanctions regimes up against the United Kingdom, for example, which there are against, say, Iran, Syria, so on.
Not yet.
Not yet, at least. You know, we do still have our ambassadors in place, you know, throughout the world, you know, doing that. There are, you know, talks, we've, you know, seen some of them leaked during the election campaign to between the United Kingdom and America on potential outlines of a future trade deal. So those are still going ahead.
So I'm going to counter Steve's argument, same as with the public services. It's not an inability, it's a choice. We made a choice to have a Brexit referendum. We're making a choice to carry on down a disastrous path with that. And those choices are likely to lead to the breakup of the UK, thus further diminishing us on the world stage because we will quite simply be smaller and less powerful.
But so I think we're maybe understating it at the moment. Not just loss of status, but just in terms of loss of reputation as well. So to the British state signing up to, say, to the Irish backstop and then reneging on that promise. Signing up to, say, paying the divorce bill and then reneging on that promise. Several times in the EU-UK negotiations, the UK state has made obligations it then doesn't feel it needs to carry out. And part of that, as we've said, Steve, is because the UK government is more interested in trying to manipulate domestic opinion or an influence and manage domestic opinion rather than worrying about what its reputation looks like to the outside world. So I'd say actually what you guys have talked about understates the amount to which actually I don't know if we're seen as a trusted actor in terms of will future UK governments be, will their word be trusted?
Whilst, I mean, that's true, but I think the European Union is fairly used to the UK being a perfidious Albion. Again, it's happening in a different way, but we're still participating, albeit definitely we've suffered reputational damage for that. Context is important here because the promises and the chaos that the UK is doing on the international stage is completely overshadowed by the chaos and the broken promises of the United States at the moment.
So not necessarily in EU capitals, I wonder.
I mean, I think in both. You know, when you look at Angela Merkel trying to deal with the NATO alliance, as an example, or Macron or Trudeau, you know, the way that this is happening is the same. And, you know, you look at that came out recently during the NATO summit in London, you know, Trudeau and Macron, was it Trudeau and Macron and Boris Johnson joking about Donald Trump? Now, in that, Boris Johnson is the insider and Donald Trump is the outsider. So, you know, still seen as being more on that inside than the Trump administration.
I suppose it is interesting that in terms of Johnson's decision, say, to place the UK, he's trying to place the UK with the EU in terms of, say, the Iranian negotiations and also over NATO spending as well. So there has been a bit of a... It's a really good point, I think, that you make, that there's more of a sense of trying to position ourselves with Europe rather than with America. Quite how that takes us into a US-UK trade deal, not quite sure, but I think there's a... Yeah.
Again, context is important, and also the fact that I think clearly there is a feeling that Trump may not be there in 12 months' time.
Oh, he will be. No one gives a crap what he does. He'll still be there, impeached or not.
Oh, great. I thought we were almost going to end on hope.
We never end on hope, Corey.
Happy Christmas, everyone.
It's all right. They'll elect Joe Biden and we'll be fine.
There's a reason we broadcast from a bunker.
So, we have a website, which is notenoughchampagne.com. Our Facebook page is facebook.com/notenoughchampagne. James Cram designed our logo. You can follow him on Twitter at James Cram, and Dave Depp is responsible for our theme tune, Pookie Good Times. I'm at Twitter at Paperback Rioter.
At Bridget Jones.
At Councillor John Cotton.
At LJD Labour.
At Acoustic Radical.
Happy plotting. Oh, and happy Christmas, I suppose. One of those.
Merry Christmas.
Hark the Herald Tribune sings, advertising wondrous things.